The Athletic.
Hello, thank you for taking the time to listen to us today. Welcome to the Zonal Marking Euros Notebook, episode 1 of 8. I'm Ali Maxwell, and with me, Michael Cox and Tom Warville of The Athletic. And this is our first in-tournament Euros offering. A two-part preview, of course, beforehand, which we hope you enjoyed. What are we going to try and do during the tournament? Well, we're basically trying to wedge ourselves in between each round of matches with some ZM-style discussion of the tournament. So I think the notebook title sums it up pretty well. We're not taking on the dailies, that's for sure. We're not going to cover every game, every team in every episode, and we won't be deep sea diving either. I think things age quickly, of course, and we don't want that, do we? So, quite simply, I've asked the guys for some astute observations from the first round of fixtures, and we'll have a natter through them as well. Think of it like tapas, a load of tasty small plates to soak it all up, and there's been plenty to soak up as well. Michael Cox, you're a major tournament obsessive and a historian as well. How do you think the first round of matches have been so far as a spectacle?
I thought you were going to call me a big tapas fan, Ali, which would have been true, but I tell you what, I've really enjoyed it, actually. I think it's just been, I feel slightly reinvigorated having watched so much kind of behind closed doors football. I think the fans has made a big difference. And I don't think it's been a bad game so far. I mean, we're talking about after 8 games, we've seen everyone play once. There's only been 1-0, which was Spain-Sweden. I thought there were plenty of, well, a couple of very good chances in that game. And not many kind of massive thrashings where the game has been over quickly. I guess Belgium against Russia, probably the exception there. Overall, I think the quality of football has been good. The tempo has been good. In general, maybe a couple of the warmer games, particularly England-Croatia, I think was slightly sluggish, because I just think it was very hot and difficult for teams to press. But overall, I've been pleasantly surprised. I think tournaments usually take a while to get going, but I'm not sure this one has.
Don't ask me how I know this, but in Benidorm, there is a place called Tapas Alley, just a whole street of tapas restaurants. I've been there once, and I don't know if I chose badly or whether they're all bad, but it was some of the worst that I've ever had. So I would avoid it, even if it sounds like it might have been named after me. Tom, how have you enjoyed the tournament? Of course, we spoke in the preview about the release of The Radar, which was one of the biggest projects that yourself and The Athletic have undertaken together. I think it's gone down so well and has been a great companion for me while watching these games to learn about 60 players in the tournament. Who's been the best Radar performer so far, would you say?
That's a great question. I think probably Breel Embolo, and I made that thought known on Twitter as well, just because Embolo, like, a lot of the data for him really matched up with what you saw on the field. I mean, he was pressing really aggressively, carried the ball upfield, got into great scoring positions, and he scored a goal as well. So I think that he was one where you kind of look and you think, you know, this is, we've done a good bit of work here. It's going to hopefully stand itself up to the end of the tournament.
You know, when you have to enter a password in order to access some content, that it's next level stuff. Been really enjoying that. If I've got a slightly calmer voice than usual, that's because this is Zonal Marking After Dark. This is our latest ever recording slot just after the end of France against Germany. I'm normally well tucked up by now. But Tom, of course, it's worth reminding us, what are the three different time periods in each day?
So we've got AM, which of course is in the morning. We've got PM, which is afternoon. And we've currently got ZM.
Absolutely spot on. Let's open the notebook, shall we? I think we should start with the game that I felt was the most entertaining so far. I think that's a popular view. And it was the Netherlands against the Ukraine. Just a bonkers game, unfiltered tournament football. Michael, you said on Twitter it felt very Euro 2008. What did that mean?
Well, the Netherlands were involved in some cracking games of that tournament. They packed the side with attacking players, seemed to just absolutely play France and Italy off the park in that group. So they were kind of in the group of death at the time. And then they got beaten in another real ding-dong game by Russia, obviously a kind of Eastern European side, which kind of reminded me of the game against Ukraine. I mean, it was 0-0 at half time, which seems remarkable because it was just so action-packed, but it was end-to-end stuff. I think actually I was quite impressed by the Netherlands throughout that one. I mean, I know that they gave up a 2-0 lead and then had to score a third goal themselves, but I thought they're quite impressive overall. Maybe not in terms of their pressing, but I didn't think they allowed Ukraine too many chances. Obviously, the goals came from a brilliant outside-the-box kind of classic Yarmolenko goal and then a set piece from Yarmolenko. But I thought overall it was just good to see the Netherlands back at a major tournament more than anything else.
It was only maybe 3 or 4 minutes in where I think everyone watching the game either thought or, as the case was, tweeted, hello, I think something's going on here. This feels pretty lively. As part of our notebook, I've noticed that some of the players we're going to talk about this evening are the sorts of players that you get in international football who have to interpret a different role for their national team compared to where we see them week in, week out in club football. And it feels, Michael, like Wijnaldum for the Dutch was a really leading light in this example. What a fantastic performance from him in a role that we're unused to seeing him play.
Yeah, definitely. I remember when he was a lot younger and still playing in the Eredivisie, he sometimes played more of this role, the kind of number 10 figure. But I really like the balance between the front three. It almost felt a little bit like an old school front three, the type you'd see in almost Italian football 20 years ago, where you've got three players with completely different roles. You had Redhorst up front, who I thought did a pretty good job as the battering ram. I mean, he's, I think, about 2 meters tall and uses his body very well. His back to goal play is very good. Then you had Memphis Depay, who a couple of times in the first half just went on dribbles, almost trying to lead the attack on his own. And he's done that, you know, over the last couple of seasons in Liga and has done very well at just getting the ball 30, 40 yards out and roaring past opponents on his way to a clear-cut goal-scoring chance. And then, like you say, Ed Wijnaldum, I think his goal really showed what he's all about in this Dutch side. And he's shown that over the last 2 or 3 years for the national team, kind of late running into the box. He's a goal scorer much more than he is for Liverpool. We kind of tended to see it on occasion for Liverpool. I mean, he scored those two goals against Barcelona in the famous Champions League comeback. But over the course of the season, he's kind of only been scoring 4 or 5 a season, hasn't he? Whereas at this tournament, I think he'll be, you know, a real major source of their chances and goals on this occasion. So, yeah, I just thought that worked really well, that the three of them combined well. And like I say, they all offer something different, which I think is always nice to watch.
Staying with the Dutch side, Tom, your player to watch in our pre-tournament pods was the chunky Jamie Vardy, Wout Weghorst up front, who Michael just spoke about, 2 meters tall and really puts himself about. But on the night itself, it was another player that caught your eye.
Yeah, absolutely. I was really impressed by Denzel Dumfries on the right wing back position. Someone who we've written about on the site a few times before, especially a couple of scouting pieces looking for a new right back, or right wing back, I should say, for Arsenal and also for Everton as well. And so I haven't really seen too much of Dumfries. I've seen a lot of his data. I've seen what video we could kind of crib together for those pieces, but not actually watched a full 90 of him. And I thought he was really impressive. I mean, he made some great bursts into the box from out wide. He had 11 touches inside the box, which I think at the time was more than any other player in the tournament. And just checking the numbers now, it is still the most. So it's one ahead of Breelan Bolo and two ahead of Haris Seferovic, which probably shows you how attacking Switzerland were against Wales inadvertently. And yeah, I think he scored a fantastic header as well, which shows his kind of threat in the air. So yeah, I was really, really, really impressed with Dumfries. And you can see why he's kind of the profile of someone who you could expect to see in the Premier League, just because he's playing well at a high level for his national team, and a lot of those traits you think would really work for a side who, you know, need an attacking wing back on the right hand side.
Amazing name as well, of course, which was getting a lot of attention on social media. With Denzel Dumfries and Wout Weghorst, they've got a couple of alliterative names with the same letter at the start of their first and surname. So I wonder if we could probably put together an 11 of that sort of player. Just off the top of my head, you've got Paul Pogba, Bosco Balaban. I've already gone to old players here. Zlatko Zahovic, plenty more as well where that came from. Something to think about as we chat. Michael, tactically speaking, it's only been one round of fixtures. It's only been, 12 games. But are there any strong or even any tactical themes from across the games that have caught your eye?
First, I'm going to talk about alliterative players, I'm afraid,
yes,
Ali.
I remember
about 20 years ago, Blackburn had Damien Duff and they had David Dunn. And then they had a player in their youth team called Darren Dunning, who I haven't heard of since. But people just got quite excited because he was another alliterative player whose name began with D.
Can we stick Danny Drinkwater behind them as well in that case?
Yeah, we can. Yeah, that's a good That's a good midfield quartet.
Amazingly, there's a player called Gavin Gunning as well. I wonder if him and Dunning have ever hung out.
We'll have to research that and get back to them for the next episode. But yeah, I mean, in terms of the tactical themes of the tournament, I mean, one thing I noticed in the France-Germany game tonight, which I think both sides did very well at the start of the game, was the counter-pressing and also the picking up on loose balls. I mean, you tend to get that whenever N'Golo Kanté is involved in the game, I suppose. He's excellent at that. But I mean, at past major tournaments, I think that's been a real weakness compared to the club game. There hasn't been so much counter-pressing. I think it's something that has to be done cohesively. It's something you do have to work on in training. And I think there's been a few sides that have done it really well. One being England, actually. I think at times in the first half of the game against Croatia, I thought they won the ball back really well. Mason Mount is very good in those situations. Calvin Phillips, we had a piece on the website by Mark Carey about how he was involved in regaining the ball really high. And I also thought it was a major part of Spain's game in a slightly different way, but they seem to just have an incredible number of players who would track back really quickly and surround the player who was leading the counter-attack for Sweden. And that's really all Sweden did in terms of going forward. And yeah, like I say, France-Germany again tonight, I thought that was a strength of both sides. Maybe they weren't at their fluid best going forward. Maybe that will come later in the tournament. But certainly there's a determination to win the ball quickly. And like I say, that's relatively rare international football. At international level. So that's been one of the key themes for me.
What you've got to be careful of is going heavy on the counter-press when you haven't necessarily been drilled to do so, and that makes you vulnerable and easy to play through. Let's just touch on England. In fact, when I asked you what you wanted to focus on, it wasn't Calvin Phillips, it was throw-ins?
Yeah, that was something I noticed, particularly from... I mean, the big surprise, wasn't it, was Kieran Trippi at left-back. I don't think anyone really expected that. Otherwise, the side was pretty much the same as it was in the two previous competitive games, aside from a couple of injuries. And he's obviously in there for his set pieces, at least partly. It was slightly confusing. England won one corner. He didn't take it. Mason Mount took it. So that was odd. He did take a couple of free kicks. One, a shot that hit the wall. One, a float over the top to Harry Kane, who didn't quite connect as he might have wanted on the volley. But actually, I thought the best part of his set pieces were the throw-ins. There were two excellent ones. One in particular for Raheem Sterling that led to the chance where Phil Foden had a shot deflected onto the post. And it was just the type of throw-in you just don't really see often. It was like an incisive through ball, maybe not a through ball because it was into a position between the lines, but usually you think of a throw-in that was effective as either being just quickly down the line or a real launch one into the box. But that was the type of pass that, had it been played with a player's foot, you would have said, God, that's brilliant, you know, deep-lying playmaking from Kieran Trippier. And maybe it's something England have been working on. I mean, we know that the set pieces have been a fundamental part of their approach. We know that I think there's been more focus than ever on the concept of throw-ins, particularly at Liverpool with Thomas Gronemark, who's their specialist throw-in coach. And you look at the way Leeds take throw-ins, for example, and so much rotation of positions. It's something teams have worked on more. And maybe it will be one of those little things that England do have the edge over other sides on, because there's some things England have done very well over the last couple of years. And I think Southgate is a bit of a blue sky thinker, isn't he? He's always trying to find those little marginal gains, and this might be one of them.
I spoke to Gronemark earlier in the season, and as part of that article, there was one example against Atalanta, which was almost a carbon copy of the throw that Trippier did. A kind of a player wasn't really looking to received the ball, they sprung into action and had a ton of space in the final third, and I think Liverpool even scored from it as well. So I think that there are kind of Gronemark's fingerprints all over that one example that we saw, and I'd agree with Michael there. Southgate definitely is one who likes to take inspiration from other sports. I think he's gone to the Super Bowl a couple of times and visited the training camps and things like that, and I guess, you know, you're in a privileged position as England manager to be able to do that, but good that we do kind of look elsewhere for inspiration and just try and get the, you know, that 1%, that 0.5% that might be the difference between in our case, finishing first in the group or second, or going to the final versus crashing out of the semis.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Tom, I know for you and for those in the data analytics community, it's been interesting to track the growth of professional clubs and the staff that they employ on that front. And I wonder, I think it's pretty much a given now that the majority of Premier League clubs and many of those in the EFL have a data performance analysis presence of some kind of a different size. When it comes to England, is there anything you can tell us about that side of things? Do you know of, or do you believe that the England national team has a strong data and performance analysis influence within the staff?
Yeah, so there's a guy called Rhys Long who essentially oversees most of the analysis department at the FA, and he's someone who's come over from rugby. I think he was potentially even an analyst with the Lions, or at least the Welsh national team, and I think he has a lot of control and a lot of it's a lot of his kind of work goes into deciding how do you analyse games, what data do you collect, what do you provide in terms of insights to the teams, going all the way down from the youth teams all the way up to the first team. How do you make sure we have the right players in terms of pathways? And there's some interesting stuff that they're doing. You know, they're always looking at guys who, what passports have they got? Could we get, you know, young internationals who potentially are dual nationality and try and get them early so they will play for us, and that doesn't always work out. You've got guys like Jamal Musiala who obviously chose Germany, but I imagine there are other examples lower down the age groups where we've plucked players. Probably Tomori actually is one example where I think he played for Canada as a youth international. We managed to take him away and, you know, cap tie him, and he's now excelling really for Milan.
Yeah, Noni Madueke, who's the young PSV attacker, he's one who there was a bit of a tug of war, and then he went to the ill-fated under-21 Euros group stage. So that doesn't mean that he will play for England at senior level, but at least they seem to have won the first battle there, even if they didn't, with Musiala in Germany.
Yeah, exactly. The FA have kind of an army of their own analysts, and they look to have their own game model, and they code their own data, and they supplement that with, you know, suppliers like Opta and Statsbomb and various others. But they have a large analytics staff, really, and I think that part of what they'll have at this tournament is the coaches will ask questions and they'll get answers. But also, you imagine there's probably a ton of data and video prep that's gone into every single opponent to try and find out what is our best plan of attack. And that's why I always find the kind of speculation around Southgate's decisions and choices quite baffling, because he spent months and months with an army of people completely analysing to death, like, what is the best way to attack this game and approach this game. And he's turned over more stones than, you know, we have in 10 minutes thinking about it on Twitter, probably. So, yeah, I think it's probably not written about a lot, but England probably have one of the more advanced analytics setups of any kind of team in the world, I reckon.
On that, Michael, the selection of Trippier obviously caused a lot of consternation pre-match with two other left-backs in the squad, or natural left-backs in the squad at least, and that's not even including Saka. You've been quite consistent over the years talking about how international selection, I'm quoting you here, is about building a team, not a best 11 of the season exercise. And it felt like this was quite a good example of that part of the discussion.
Yeah, like I say, it was almost identical to the side from the last two competitive games. Pickford came back after injury. Maguire was out because of injury. But yeah, the only change was at left back. In the two March, well, there are actually three games, competitive games in March, but one of them was against San Marino, so I won't count that one. But in those games, Shaw and Chilwell got a game each. Clearly didn't do quite enough to impress, but otherwise it was the same. And Southgate has had this idea. I mean, even down to the fact that Foden played generally on the right for England. I think when most people were building their kind of favoured starting 11 before the tournament, myself included, to be fair, would probably have had him on the left, or maybe in a number 10 position, maybe he's number 8. But Southgate has almost always used him from the right. And he's generally done well there. I don't think he was at his best in the game against Croatia. But as I looked at for the article I did on the back of that, his game was all about drawing out the left back and having Phillips running into the space in behind. And that
was our friend Pep that we spoke about in the preview. Pep Gvardiol Josep Gvardiol. He was a left back.
He was a young 19-year-old who I think made his senior debut last week, I think I'm right in saying. So yeah, a difficult, competitive debut for him. But yeah, it's all about team building. I think the successful sides tend not to be thrown together on the eve of the tournament. I think there generally is a plan there, albeit it can evolve throughout the tournament. I think we will see rotation from England throughout the group stage and maybe some more tactical variety in the knockouts.
I think we've spoken on this podcast before about Foden's ideal role, and obviously Michael mentioned there that he's mainly played on the right wing for England, and I think we've spoken before about, you know, perhaps he's better suited as a free eight, but I think we did see against Croatia he's just pretty lazy when it comes to tracking back and putting pressure on the ball. I found wasn't overly keen on, you know, he has the pace to keep up with most players and he wasn't really using that to full effect. So I'm interested to see, you know, is that the reason why he's never really playing in the midfield? Because can you trust him to be part of that kind of counter-pressing unit? Can you trust him to kind of put in that intense running? He's probably much more suited to kind of be a pain as an outball to the opposition fullback and pin them back there. So, yeah, I guess that one for me was a light bulb moment in terms of, okay, this is why he's probably not done that up to this point, why we might not see him in midfield until he adds that to his game.
And standout for England was Calvin Phillips, who has gone from a star performer in the Championship. He played his last game in July of last year to a star performer in the European Championships, just 11 months between the two. What a performance. And another player, a bit like Wijnaldum, who we mentioned, showing ability to perform in a different role to his duties under Bielsa at Leeds. And Michael wrote a brilliant piece about this on the Athletic site, so do go and read that and sign up if you haven't already. The current offer is £1 a month for the first 6 months of your annual subscription, so make the most of that. theathletic.com/zonal marking there. Now, on Monday night, Spain came up against Sweden. Real cat and mouse stuff. Tom, what stood out for you watching this fixture?
I think what I was most impressed by at times was, and I'm going to go for the pun and it's late, so I apologise, but Sweden's flat pack four, where I thought they were just very kind of well organised and they weren't overly manipulated too much by Spain's kind of prodding and probing, although they did kind of get walloped in the XG battle, and it's probably just down to Spain's poor finishing that they didn't win the game. But I thought Lindelof and I think Danielson next to him handled things fairly well. I thought they passed Morata off to each other, you know, decently, and I think both of them cleared the ball the most and second most of any player in the tournament so far, which shows just how much they had to work with. So we spoke about Lindelof before, and I think Coxie put him in his team of the season, and I think that maybe we saw a bit of a different game from him because he just had to sit so far back, and he probably doesn't have to do that at United, and he's exposed for his, you know, seemingly lack of pace and lack of strength. But I thought he was pretty solid for Sweden. I guess the other side, of course, you know, the reason why the number of clearances was so high is because Sweden was so deep. And it meant Spain had a ton of possession. I think they had more possession, 84%, I think, was the figure put out by Opta, which is the highest at a Euros game ever, perhaps. But the interesting thing that I found, which is one of these kind of quirky nuggets, is that Spain had 38 sequences which had 10 or more passes against Sweden. And that's 21 more, than Wickham had in the whole of the season of the Championship, which, bear in mind, that's a 46-game season, and this is one game for Spain against Sweden. And I think two other teams as well had more of those sequences than Wickham did. So I just thought that was a great stat and showing just how committed Wickham are to never having more than 10 passes. If you get to the ninth one, just kick it into the stands and recycle and go from there.
From quirky nugget to tactical meatball. Michael, you enjoyed this Sweden performance very much in their own image, which is always comforting.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think this is the only game I haven't watched live. Because
disgraceful. Absolutely disgraceful.
Well, I was at the cricket, and two, there was a free slot at 2 p.m. today with no games. So I gave myself a 2 p.m. game from last night. But of course, I saw the game. Oh, sorry, I saw the scoreline before I'd seen the game. And I thought, I bet I can work out how that game has gone. 0-0. I think I know what happened there. And yeah, I mean, I wrote an article on the eve of this tournament about how, I mean, one of the things I've always liked about international football is how you have certain styles, certain countries have certain styles that they've played for decades and decades. And I think that has slightly gone out of the game. I mean, I don't think this current Italian side look typically Italian. I don't think this England side look typically English. And the two I thought before the tournament maybe had lined up as looking like their old selves were Croatia and Sweden. Croatia, I didn't think were very Croatian against England. Usually I expect them to completely dominate the game. I don't think they did that. But Sweden are always just so well drilled. They always play 4-4-2. That has pretty much gone out of favour for almost every other international side. I can't think of many decent sides still playing 4-4-2. But they do it in a really organised manner. And I think that they counterattack well at times through Alexander Isak, who is one of the most exciting players at the tournament. I think showed that despite not scoring, he had one good chance. And of course, there was the one he created for Marcus Berg as well. And yeah, it was good to see a kind of very familiar team. I think that's one of the nice things about an international tournament where, you know, haven't seen Sweden play probably more than twice over the last 3 years. And yet you sit down, you watch them. They've still got Sebastian Larsson there. They've still got another couple of players who are very familiar, and they still play the same way. And like I say, for me, that's what international football is all about.
On Tuesday night, tonight, really, if I'm trying to keep this timeless because I'm ever the professional, the most eye-catching fixture on paper of the first round of fixtures was surely France and Germany. France won it 1-0, and obviously because they are the world champions and people are holding them to very high standards, especially due to the names on the team sheet, a lot of people not too enamoured with their style of play, even in beating Germany 1-0. Tom, could we sum it up as liberté, égalité, passivité?
Absolutely fantastic. You can tell we're recording this late. I think we probably can, Ali. What we saw, I think, with Germany was the game against Germany, even, is that, you know, France got the goal, the own goal, which was kind of preceded by a luscious aerial through ball by Paul Pogba, which I thought was a stand-up player on the night. And the passivité, as you say, was that France's passes per defensive action, so how many passes they allowed Germany before France looked to stick a foot in and win it back, was 56. So they allowed 56 passes before they tried to do anything about it, which I have a bit of a question mark whether that's an error in the data, just because it seems so high. It's more than Sweden was against Spain, and just shows that I think they were obviously passive, but I think they were well drilled and forced Germany out wide and backwards. But yeah, that was the story of the game. I think they got a goal up, and much maybe like England. And I was thinking about this when I was watching it, that I think a large proportion of England fans are probably quite frustrated that we're not as attacking as we could be, given the magnitude of talent we have, attacking talent as well in the squad. But I think it's probably more frustrating as a France fan that you're not seeing at least two or three goals and then really trying to go for it, just because the talent they have in the squad at home, in the under-21s, kind of throughout the country is so forward-thinking. I mean, they've picked the wrong Hernandez, really, at fullback, whereas Teo is arguably the best attacking fullback in Europe, really, and Lucas was, I thought he was okay, but he's not quite his brother. So, that's just one observation. But overall, yeah, passivité was the order of the day against Germany.
Michael, everyone's got a different view on how they want to watch football be played. I think most people understand that at international level, you can't necessarily expect the same aesthetics as at club level, especially when it comes to positional play and you know, sort of set piece movements within possession and that sort of fluid attacking play. But also when it comes to France, it feels like this suits their personnel as well. So long as they can soak up a bit of pressure from the opposition and drop a little deeper, it's not hard to understand how that could bring the best out of arguably the best player in the tournament in Kylian Mbappe. And, you know, even if he didn't score the goal tonight, he was pretty close on a few occasions with those disallowed goals. And I mean, don't you think that this just suits the personnel that they have?
Yeah, I always think people have been slightly harsh on Didier Deschamps when you look at their record over the last two tournaments. I mean, I think it's clear that they do have the best squad, the best, you know, pool of talent to pick from, but I don't find them particularly boring. I think they are relatively deep at times. They are reactive, certainly when they go ahead, but like you say, I just find the threat of Mbappe on the break absolutely thrilling. And there were three or four times where he launched counters, obviously the two disallowed goals and the one where Hummels had to make a very last gasp tackle on him, and in those situations, yeah, I just find it so exciting. So yeah, personally, I have no issue with the way Deschamps is playing. I think people are sometimes asking for a little bit too much in terms of, like you say, international football is not played in the same way as club level. And I can't think really of a side who've entertained all the way through a tournament, probably since Brazil in 2002 in terms of the sides who've actually won the tournament. So, yeah, you'd hope for maybe one or two vintage displays from France. But I think in a group this difficult, Deschamps is probably almost treating it as a knockout tournament from the get-go. Yeah, hopefully there's one or two more sparkling performances, but I kind of get why Deschamps plays the way he does.
Tom, just going back to that Netherlands-Ukraine game briefly, with the, I mean, just the colours of the kit, the green pitch, the helter-skelter action. Clearly you were as overstimulated by this affair as I was, because you wanted to flag up another player from this game and another one of those great examples of someone who has to fill a different role for his national team compared to his club side.
Yeah, I thought Alexander Zinchenko was really good on the night, someone that we've spoken about before. And when I did kind of the piece on City's passes and the passes that won them the title, I thought he was just someone who, under pressure, is so good. And we saw a different side of him against the Dutch. We saw kind of an extended passing range. We saw a lot of energy in midfield. I think he had 8 true tackles, which is tackles and challenges which are lost, and also fouls conceded when attempting a tackle. And I think he won all of them cleanly as well, which just shows that he's kind of got the ability to execute his tackles to match that. So yeah, I just thought he's someone who I'd like to see more of in a kind of midfield role. And you could argue that he's wasted it at City, or at least, you know, you could, you know, a team that are lower down the table could probably benefit from having a player like him in midfield. But also, if you're Zinchenko, you're probably not going to pass up working with Pep to work with Steve Bruce, for example. So yeah, another example like Wijnaldum, of someone who moonlights away from home, is a completely different player.
And Michael, referees, love them or hate them, every football match needs them. And I know that all three of us agree that it's a shame how much of football discourse is taken up by talking about refs and their decisions. But I'm a big believer that it's good to be kind, and it's not difficult to be kind. And you've got something nice to say about the refs.
Yeah, I think the quality has been good. Can't remember too many scandalous decisions or controversial decisions.
But you're part of the problem, Michael. That might have been tongue-in-cheek, but the use of a word like scandalous to describe a refereeing decision, you're part of the problem. Be part of the solution.
Well, here's my part of being the solution. Yeah, I think the quality has been very good. And also just the style has been good. I'm not one of these who thinks that, like, you know, who rails against football becoming a non-contact sport or that kind of thing. But there's just been a sense from the referees they're telling players to get on with it. You know, they haven't indulged them. There's been a lot of referees very visibly waving away any process and just getting on with the game. And I think that's just given the game a real nice rhythm, combined with obviously the supporters, which I personally think just transforms the feel of games completely. So yeah, that's a positive. There's been no no reason to focus on anything aside from the players.
Well done, the refs. Tom, lastly, David Marshall, the Scotland goalkeeper, unfortunately is the one that went viral after their game against the Czech Republic. But you wanted to flag up the performance of another Scotsman at the other end of the field.
Yeah, I guess we say Scotsman, but Lyndon Dykes is Australian by birth, I think. But anyway, that may be controversial. Lyndon Dykes he stood out for me, not just because of his hair, but he won 6 of his 16 aerial duels, which was the most attempts and a kind of below average rate of winning them. But he actually got into the best scoring positions of any forward we've seen so far in the tournament. And his XG is 1.12, and that's higher than anyone else, even Ronaldo, when you take his penalty out of the equation. So I thought that was kind of telling that I think the Scots played pretty well. And I think there's probably a game state element where the Czechs kind of took their foot off the gas a little bit in that game. But I thought that they played pretty well, and I think that he's probably one that we shouldn't underestimate. You know, England shouldn't underestimate, and Croatia certainly shouldn't either. And yeah, he's probably the best option they have up front. I thought Che Adams came on actually and combined well with him and dropped deep into the midfield and played some kind of neat interchanges there too. Probably better than Ryan Christie, who was floating all over the place and didn't combine too well up front. So yeah, I thought if Dykes does start, one to be aware of.
Yeah, it was a bit of a blow that Scotland and Poland both lost, because there were quite a few of us, sort of underground group, who were really hoping for them both to finish second in their groups, D and E, come up against each other on the 18th of June in Copenhagen, so that we could see Lewandowski against Lyndon Dykeski at once and for all. But we might need to wait till Dykes makes it to the Champions League for that to happen. That's it from us. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Zone Final Marking Podcast Euros Notebook. That was episode 1 of 8, as mentioned. We're going to be back over the weekend between round 2 and 3 and between each round of the Euros until its end. Make sure you subscribe to this podcast on whichever podcast platform you use. You can listen without adverts on the Athletic site and app. And of course, you can subscribe to The Athletic right now by heading to theathletic.com/zonalmarking, where you'll be met with an offer that you'll pay just £1 a month for the first 6 months of your annual subscription. But from me, from Gavin Gunning and Darren Dunning, it's goodbye for now. And we'll leave you with one more name, Razvan Rat.
The Athletic.